Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. In today's episode, we have a celebrity guest, if I may call him that, Jack from the famous cricket podcast. Hello, Jack. Welcome to the ACP.
Thanks very much, Ajit. Thanks for having me. I don't think I've ever been introduced as a celebrity before, but I'll take it.
Fair enough. I mean, you heard it here first, right? So on your way up, I hope you remember it.
Will do. Yeah, for sure.
All right. How have you been doing?
Yeah, I've been really good. I'm obviously loving the Ashes. The hundreds underway. I've watched a bit of that. It's quite therapeutic after an intense series like the Ashes to tune into some less intense cricket, some domestic stuff. So yeah, been having a good time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Perfect. So Ashes is already in your rearview mirror. It's been only a couple of days. You're still not living the game, the way England finished on the last day.
To some extent, yeah. I think I said this on our show. I stand by it. I think it was the best series that I can remember as a cricket fan. I think it had everything that you would want, barring maybe a decider. And I'm sure we'll get to that and talk about sort of what it means and who was the better team and so on. But I think, yeah, what more can you want from a cricket series? Mm-hmm. A test match series, 4 incredibly close games, kind of a frustrating rain off some brilliant individual performances, 2 completely different styles of cricket. It will live certainly long in the memory, but also in a way, it's almost a relief to de-stress and to think about life without the Ashes as the main talking point, as the main focus.
Fair enough. Look, I had predicted it to all, and before the series started, that is, and I was actually disappointed to see it to all. The way they came back, England deserved to win the series, and I think they were robbed. You know, wasn't it Old Trafford where it rained off? And I feel it should have been their game. And I dare say, had the game gone on, they would have found a way to win that game.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're probably right. On the other hand, the 2 matches they did win, Australia had a lot of chances to win those games. So there was the possibility that the Australia, they got Chris Wokes out at Headingley, mm-hmm. or Steve Smith didn't edge Wokes again to second slip and completed what should have been quite an easy victory, I think, at one point after tea on day 5 at the Oval. So, look, it could have gone both ways. And that, I think, was the magic of the series, really. It was that, you know, not only were the matches so close, but each day's play seemed to go from one team being in control to the other team being in control. And then at the end of the day, you were saying, well, who's going to win this match? We've got no idea. It's a complete 50-50. And I'll say it again. I can't remember anything like it in Test match cricket. And bring on the next one in a way, you know.
Absolutely. No. Look, I mean, if you go back to the last day, I mean, emotions riding high, Broad having declared his innings closed previous evening. And more or less certain Ali would not continue on, right? So a lot of emotions, do you think, in the England dressing room?
Oh, I think without a doubt. I think it was written in a way, wasn't it, that Broad would be the man that came back and took the two final wickets. Just as, I don't know, maybe England were getting a little bit nervous at that Todd Murphy, Alex Carey partnership, that he would come on. Mm. I think he said after the match that do you remember he swapped the bails over before his final delivery of the over that he got Todd Murphy out on?
Yeah.
He thought that was going to be his last ball ever in Test match cricket. Ben Stokes had told him that Mark Wood was going to come on and replace him the next over. So he thought he'd do that as a kind of jokey sign-off, I think. And he picks up the wicket. Then next over, he gets Carey. It was a magical spell. At the other end, slightly more, at the other end, you had Moeen Ali twirling away, and he picked up massive, massive wickets with Steve Smith and Mitch Marsh and then Pat Cummins falling in reasonably quick succession in that mad half an hour. I think you're right. It was partly fueled by emotion. It was to really incredibly influential players over the last decade in Test match cricket. One of them in Moeen Ali, the most liked, one of the most liked players in the English game, certainly in the recent English game. Mm-hmm. And then the other, the kind of pantomime villain, and without a doubt, a genuine great of English cricket, Stuart Broad, being the guys who brought it home. You genuinely couldn't have framed it any better. And it kind of, you know, it's sort of funny in a way. It also relegates Chris Wokes, who was the player of the series, to a secondary role, and that's a role that he has occupied frequently for England over the last half a decade, 5 years, maybe a bit longer. Raw emotion and the crowd going ballistic, and the beautiful send-off and the sunset over the Oval, which is the iconic ground, one of the iconic grounds of English cricket, probably the most beautiful ground in English cricket. You couldn't really have asked for much more, I don't think, in terms of what happened after tea. From an English point of view, I mean, I think if you're an Australian, you'd have probably asked for another 50 runs, but sitting here as an Englishman, I thought it was a fantastic ending to a great series.
I totally agree. It was unfortunate that, you know, Australia ended up losing. But you're right in as much that after that start that they had to the second innings, the way Khwaja and Warner had started, I thought Warner was also looking for a last over in England of his own, potentially, even maybe Khwaja, because it's highly unlikely either of them will come back to tour England again.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we're talking about the England guys signing off there. And I was probably being a little bit biased and framing it from the point of view of the victor. And they say history is written by the victor, don't they? And I think certainly for that Test match, that is true. And that's how a lot of the rest of the Ashes series will be framed, certainly by the English anyway. But from the Australian point of view, it's not just Khwaja and Warner that won't come back. Mitchell Starc probably won't return. Probably won't see Hazelwood. Yeah. Cummins will be 34 the next time they come back to England. I think Steve Smith will be in his late 30s. Obviously, he's a genius, so I expect him to come back, but he won't be a young man. Travis Head will be the wrong side of 30. Mitch Marsh, don't see him coming back again. This was a moment for that Australia team. This was a moment, and after tea, they were the favourites to win the match, that would have defined careers. This would have been the legacy that they created for a great Australian Test team. They came to England, they beat India in the World Test Championship final, they take home a trophy there, they go 2-0 up, few jitters in the third and the fourth match. If they had taken it home when Smith and Head looked so good, or Warner and Khwaja earlier in the day and on day four, they would have been talked about as as a brilliant generation of Australian cricketers. Now I think the legacy will be framed slightly differently, and they'll probably be the nearly men in a way, as well as they played. And Khawaja himself was at pains to talk about how this is an Australian side that has won two Ashes in a row and retained the Ashes two other times. And so for what's that, 12 years, mm-hmm. have held the urn, which is a pretty fantastic achievement in a historic rivalry. Mm-hmm. But because they couldn't quite do it in this Oval Test match, there'll always be question marks, I think. And that's the greatness of Test cricket, I think, in a way that it's this constantly unfolding story, the never ending novel. Mm-hmm. And for these guys, or for this chapter of Australian cricket, it probably will end with a slightly bittersweet tinge.
Yep. Another great who might never turn up for Australia in England, Nathan Lyon.
Yeah, and what a sad way for him to go out.
Yeah.
To be honest. Mm-hmm. Interesting that it was in a win for Australia, and that he in a way did his bit with the bat, didn't he? Coming
yeah,
out
yeah, yeah.
As a, you know, to play a brave innings. I believe he talked about how his wife and him had the discussion, and his wife called him an idiot for saying that he would go out and bat, and then he did it. So he probably lost a few brownie points in the domestic relationship. Oh, but that's the kind of cricketer he is. I think the series lost something for him not being there. He's been a tormentor for England for many years.
I mean, at Leeds, I think he would have eaten England up. They were lucky he wasn't there.
Exactly. Exactly. Who's to say which way the series would have gone had they had a bowler that Pat Cummins was more comfortable throwing the ball to? It was very obvious at Leeds that he didn't fancy Todd Murphy. Yeah. And that he was a bit nervous to bowl him. I don't think that would have been the case with Lyon, and maybe he'd have got the breakthrough that they needed.
Absolutely. So that's one thing. I mean, if you look at the scorecard overall, like, first of all, Chris Wokes, bit late in the day, but coming into his own, given that now there's going to be no more Broad in the lineup. Anderson, well, we'll get to Anderson shortly, but let's first talk about Wokes. I thought he's more or less resigned to playing at home from now on, but what a way to show that he's ready to take the mantle of maybe the second best bowler in the 11. Maybe has he leapfrogged Ollie
Robinson.
Oh, God. So I've even forgotten his name. It's just two tests. Fantastic. All right. Tell me.
I think at home, yeah, I would agree with that. And I think there's a little window now where Wokes will be a very important player for England. I mean, he's not a young man himself. I think he's 33.
Exactly. Yeah.
The way players keep themselves in shape, he's probably got 2 to 4 more years in the tank. Mm. You know, he'd be the same age as Broad is now in the next Ashes. And would you bet against him coming out one more time for home Ashes? I agree with you that he is limited and that he will always be more effective in England and probably isn't ever going to be the great tourist.
Yeah.
But you look across England's next away tours. Well, there's 5 matches in India. I think they can find someone to bowl his overs there, probably a spinner.
Yeah.
And then is it Pakistan and New Zealand the next two tours? It might not be New Zealand. I think it's Pakistan, maybe it's South
Pakistan
Africa.
Pakistan for sure. And also South Africa.
Yeah. On the next cycle, you know, I think again in Pakistan, England will look at other options and they've got players that will probably be better suited for that. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think in modern Test cricket, having home specialists is necessarily a problem. You look at Akshar Patel for India, for example, or maybe to a lesser extent, Scott Boland for Australia. Guys who are world beaters at home that you might not want to throw the ball to in adverse away conditions. And does that mean they don't have a role in the squad? Absolutely not. And I think, you know, good for Chris Wokes that he's proved once again that he's a warrior at home. And I for one, look forward to seeing him again next summer against the West Indies and Sri Lanka.
You know, I'm just thinking somebody like him might not be a bad pick while going to the subcontinent. I mean, then comes the question really of Anderson, right? Do you see Anderson touring again for England?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think if it's a choice, in a weird way, between Anderson and Wokes for the subcontinent, and let's throw Robinson in there as well, I think that Anderson has a little bit more to his game in those conditions, in that he has the capacity and the patience to bowl dry and to hold up an end and to, you know, bowl spells with a slightly old ball, actually to give the spinners a rest sometimes.
Right.
That don't go for many runs. And I think Robinson has that as well. They're both, well, Robinson, that's really his trick, is that he is an exceptional line and length bowler. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing in the subcontinent, I don't think. We also saw Robinson get a little bit of reverse swing in Pakistan, which is a nice string to his bow.
Yes.
Wokes, I think, is more of a pure English seam bowler. I don't see his game transferring as well. And I think his batting might be slightly limited as in Indian conditions. So I don't think that England will go with him for India. And England actually, you know, in the Baz McCullum era anyway, have shown that they're very prepared to be flexible in terms of their bowling attack in away conditions. So, I mean, I don't know if Wokes will see himself as the victim of that selection policy. he will probably understand it, to be honest, and maybe he'll, in a way, be relieved that he doesn't have to go on a 5-test tour of India. But I do think that's the way that they'll, England will go. They'll go away from Wokes for 5 matches, and then we'll see him return to the team for the English summer, which is, well, 11 months away now, which is slightly ridiculous when you put it like that.
Yeah, fair enough. See, I was also thinking, it's happened that greats have inspired each other to retire at the same time. At least in Australia, it has happened multiple times. I was also thinking maybe Anderson may decide to call time, but he's been saying the same thing throughout. I'm happy to see he's stuck to his guns. He says at the end of the series, I'm going to go back and then take a call. I'm not in a hurry. And I like that.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't be surprised if conversations have been had between Anderson and the England selectors, and the captain and the management. And I wouldn't be surprised if the conversation went something along the lines of, don't worry about the summer that you've just had, Jimmy. We know what you have. We know what your skills are. We still want you around. And actually, I wonder in this case whether Broad retiring means that Anderson is even more important. If they both go at once, that is a big gap to fill.
Correct.
If there's one of them still about, even in a limited capacity, that's a player that other players can learn from. And I think, no disrespect to these two teams, but I do think next summer, not Pakistan, Sri Lanka and West Indies will present a less challenging opponent for Anderson. And I think with 700 wickets just round the corner and potentially Shane Warne on the horizon.
710.
I think he might fancy one more go at that. you know, would you begrudge him that chance? A man with nearly 700 wickets, probably the greatest English seam bowler ever, probably the greatest English bowler ever, maybe England's greatest ever Test cricketer.
Look,
would you rush him out the door?
No.
With what's on the agenda for next summer on the table?
Look,
I wouldn't.
I wouldn't either. But I don't want England to arrange a Tendulkar style farewell series for him either. I mean, that's the only thing.
I think that is a fair point. And I think this is where Anderson needs to be honest with himself as well.
Exactly.
He's the one that will know whether he didn't take wickets this year because he was unlucky, or because he was against batters that matched up well against him, or because the pitches didn't suit him. And that if any of those things change, if his luck turns, or the pitches are easier, or the batters that he's facing are, you know, less competent against the swinging ball, then if he thinks that he can come back into it, and he can be a threat, then, you know, England should trust his call. If he knows in his heart of hearts that the reason he didn't take wickets is because he's lost, they call it a little bit of nip, don't they? Mm. He's lost a little bit of nip, then he should. He should do the honourable thing. But I believe at this point in time, the ball should be in his court.
Not totally. There is no doubt in my mind that he's earned the right to pick and choose when he goes out into the sun or sunset. So, yeah, I agree what you're saying. I also expect he's a very mature person. I mean, he does show that on the field as well. And you won't want to begrudge such a person any silly, you know, there's no stay out, there's no other way sort of stuff. So I would expect he will have a chance to make his own mind up. And knowing him, I somehow think he'll not pick to go out just to chase a record. So, but yeah, we'll see how he goes through the winter, right? And based on that, you can take that call. So, yeah, I'm going to wait it out as well.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
There's another element to this as well. Mm. It's a risk. It is a risk for England to keep Anderson around for another year. I think that's undoubtable. Mm. He will be 41 going on 42 next summer. But there is also a risk that they ask a bowler that would potentially be their best bowler to retire early if they push him out the door. And that risk, as we touched upon, is exacerbated by Broad retiring, I think. Mm-hmm. And there's a risk by doing that instead of having two reliable bowlers for next summer, in a World Test Championship cycle where they'll still think they have a chance of making the final for whatever that's worth, there is a risk that they go into next summer with no dependable bowlers.
Yeah, yeah.
With Ollie Robinson and his injury record, and no Broad and no Anderson, and Chris Wokes maybe not having played a test match for a year. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to bear that in mind too, if you're an England selector or an England fan, or if you're someone who just thinks he's old and should leave. Mm. I think there is more to this.
No, come on. There's no room for he's old, he should leave. He's old, he should leave because he's not performing, makes more sense, right? And he's one of the fittest guys out there. I mean, come on. He's quite a role model that way. So, okay, all right. Let's see if... let's see how it goes with the Anderson saga. But, you know, nice to actually hear your thoughts, because also, if you look at the biggest gainers on both sides, you see Joe Root sort of stamping his authority again. Johnny Bairstow, who's come back with such a lot of criticism he's faced and come back in the last two tests to prove his point. Stuart Broad, all the time lurking around the corner, always a threat, right? Mark Wood and Chris Wokes, really, their infusion changed the series for England, right? So for me, one of the biggest gainers, sort of in a very quiet way, was Zach Crawley.
Oh, no, not even in a quiet way. Mm. I mean, Zach Crawley came into the series as, historically speaking, the worst opening batter of all time. and he leaves the series as, you know, and this is hyperbolic, but people have been saying this, the closest thing that modern cricket has to Virender Sehwag.
Yeah,
that's quite the transformation in six weeks. Yeah, yeah. That's an incredible transformation.
You don't get compared to Sehwag every day, man. That's quite something.
Exactly. But people have been. Look, I think it's probably a little bit over the top, and he probably had a run of form, and inarguably he was a little bit lucky in some of those innings. Mm. But there's no denying now that we can all see the vision behind Zach Crawley.
Yeah.
Because we just saw it for five test matches. Mm. And let's not beat around the bush here. He destroyed Australia.
Yeah.
He had moments where they could not bowl to him.
Agreed.
He had plenty of other moments where they knew exactly how to bowl to him, don't get me wrong. But when he was firing, he was an incredible threat. Yeah, massive winner, Zach Crawley. And I think he's bought himself a lot more rope from an England point of view. Mm-hmm. I expect to see him around for quite a long time to come.
I mean, I expect him to be successful as well. You know, somewhat, I think if you perform in the Ashes series, I think it changes you as a player, especially if you are from England, I think. To go out there, prove yourself against Australia gives you a whole new lease of life. and belief. And he's done that. He's done that very good. And you also see what you said, right? What was the whole point of having this guy in the 11? You see it now. And yeah, nice to see. Actually, I sort of backed him from the outset. He's still young enough. He has a decade to offer to England if they'll have him. And his average is headed the right way. His attitude is always excellent. So you can now forget talking about that one double hundred that always defined his career, I guess.
Oh, I mean, the other thing with Crawley, he was unlucky in a way that the Old Trafford test was rained off. Otherwise, he would have been a serious shout for man of the series.
Correct.
And that's
correct.
That's no exaggeration. He played the innings in the series which had the most impact on the likely outcome of the game, and then it rained.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is unfortunate for him.
Yes.
But we all saw it. We can now all see, and we all know that it happened, and he knows it happened. And you talk about average. I think his average now is up to 31.5,
yeah,
which puts him slightly ahead of the realistically the other England opening batting candidates, Rory Burns and Dom Sibley and all of the other guys that they tried. None of them averaged more than 31.5, so you might as well have the guy that you know has 189 of 188 balls in his locker.
Correct.
I think it breaks down like that.
And not only that, see, if you can perform even, I won't say half as good as this, because there's always more to be done, but if he can approach this in his performance, one innings like that every series, I mean, that then you are talking Sehwag, right? One defining innings of the series. I mean, there are very few people like Sehwag. I mean, for me, he's always been special. I actually, one of the people I thought who played the most impactful cricket in that era, in that team, between him and Zahir Khan, I think, and Lakshman to an extent, were the people who took India to number one in tests before they retired, that is, right? So I have a lot of time for somebody like him, and maybe he's headed in the right way, right?
Yeah, look, hopefully. I mean, like, just to be clear, I mean, I don't think he's as good as Sehwag, but a player in the mold of.
Fair enough.
And there is, I think there's always room in a team like England for a player in the mold of Sehwag.
Absolutely. I mean, look, your opener, much like your fast bowling opener in most cases, is also an attacker. He's potentially also one of your best batsmen. So why not, right? It makes sense. All right, that was that. And then, any parting thoughts?
On the Ashes in general? Mm-hmm. I just sort of want to do it all again, in a way. I think there's a lot of people in England who are sort of disappointed that we've still got a whole month and a half of the summer to go, and there's no Test cricket to play now.
Oh yeah.
And that things have sort of wrapped up soon, and there are reasons for that, and the reason for that isn't the 100.
Yeah, yeah.
As some people would have you believe, but it does feel like it's come to an end a little bit soon, and that's a shame. And I think the other thing I'd say is that there's a lot of credit that is due to Australia in this series.
Absolutely.
I genuinely think that virtually every other team in world cricket, with the potential exception of India when they get it right, a fully fit India, you know, let's say Bumrah was fit right now and India were over with him. I think every team besides them, and maybe even India, would have been blown away over those five tests. And I think there's an immense amount of credit that has to go to the Australians for hanging with England when they were tearing away at multiple times through the series, and they kept taking wickets, and when it came to the batting, they kept putting totals up, and that's really to be commended. And I think the retention that they pulled off, it was rain assisted, and I think I would say that England were the better team overall. But you know, cricket isn't always fair. Test cricket isn't always fair in terms of the results it produces. And I don't think the fact that England probably were better actually diminishes the achievement of the Australians in retaining the Ashes. I think that was about as hard a series as they could have played. And to win two Test matches and to be in a position to nearly win the decider, or the one that would have given them the outright win, you know, that they're a champion team as well. And we shouldn't forget that.
Absolutely. I mean, happy to see an Englishman giving credit to the Aussies, but I mean, I'm teasing you, but that was what I was going towards as well. I mean, I thought Australia played a wonderful brand of cricket. And you could think, you know, this generation of cricketers, the Aussie cricketers, they have probably, they could have done with this win because it would have won, been one for the ages. Because I don't think beating this England at home is going to be that easy. If England can play with the same attitude, that's going to be quite something in the coming years as well. I mean, I don't think I've ever not looked forward to the English summer, but I'm going to look forward to it that much more every time. As long as...
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? All right.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Now, if you were to quickly go on to the West Indies-India series, well, there were two ODIs and the first T20I in the meantime. And, well, first of all, shall we say West Indies caught India cold in that second ODI? Where India were suddenly, but you know, bowled out for 181. And first of all, it looked like they were unwilling to bat Rohit Sharma and Kohli, though they were chosen in the first ODI. So they sort of kept promoting everyone else ahead of this Indian of their those two batters. And second and the third ODI, they were rightly rested. So if you want to see which way India is heading, West Indies, whether playing at home or away, is as good as an opportunity to check that. Would you feel the same?
Yeah, I sort of think that, but at the same time, I do. If I was being critical of India, I kind of would ask what they're hoping to achieve from this series. Mm-hmm. There's a World Cup soon,
right?
And I know that this West Indies team aren't at the World Cup, but that's more a product of a bad format for the World Cup, I think, than it is the West Indies not necessarily deserving to be there. The West Indies have got plenty of good players.
Right.
What I would kind of ask with, you know, if I was in the room with an Indian selector or the Indian think tank is, would you not want to use these matches from a batting point of view? I totally get resting bowlers. I understand that there's a heavy workload and a lot of them were involved in the Test series as well. Thinking Siraj here particularly.
Yeah.
And obviously Bumrah just coming back from injury and you kind of know what Shami's going to bring, don't you? So it's, you know, those guys, totally understand them not playing.
Mm-hmm.
With the batting, would you not at this point in time, as an Indian leader in cricket terms, would you not want to be playing near to your World Cup top seven to see how they fit together to define roles a little bit better? I mean, I'm looking at the lineup for the second ODI here. Kishan Gill, Samson Patel, Akshar Patel.
Yeah.
Hardik Pandya, Suryakumar Yadav down at, what's that, six, and then Jadeja. How many of them are going to play and how many of them are going to bat in those positions in a World Cup match? That's what I sort of wondered when I was looking at this. And I don't know if you feel the same or whether you think that this is just a complete free hit and that Rohit and Kohli being rested makes sense from a mental workload perspective. But I did think that it was interesting, the team that they played and the way they've used players.
So I think it was just more of an attempt to give some of the people who are very good bats or would be potentially very good bats if they had more time, a bit more time up the order. So I think in the first ODI, we saw Shardul being promoted. Second ODI, we saw Akshar being promoted. But then that loss sort of shook them a little, right? So I think in their own mind, just like what you said about Shami, they have a good idea what Kohli and Rohit bring to the 11. To a large extent, they want Suryakumar Yadav to sort of establish himself there. Probably he has, but you know, give him the chance to re-establish himself because he's had a fallow series suddenly in between. So then you have the likes of Sanju Samson, who you would not try out if Kohli and Rohit both were to be in the 11. Because I know he's a keeper, but you want to give Ishan Kishan that much rope. He's made himself undroppable, frankly, Ishan Kishan. Right? So you can't really drop him. Then comes the question of, how do you fit in these other players you want to try out? How do you give these other people more balls, more time in the middle? Then you decide to rest the big two. And it is against most common convention. And at the cost of even calling your West Indies 11, your opposition, not really, really much of a challenge. I mean, the results in the end proved that. they took one game almost off, and West Indies hit back, and they understood you can't take them lightly. And look at what happened in the third ODI. So,
well, yeah.
In theory, they thought in their own mind they had the result more or less sewn up, so they could really experiment a lot. Because these questions have been asked of Dravid, and he sort of responded, "This is our last chance potentially to try out some of our players we have in mind." Right, so for them it is still a chance to simply try out new people and not be worried about the result. I think if you ask him in an interview outright, he'll say we don't care about the result, but in the dressing room he'll say don't you go out there and lose this game, right? Something like this. So coming back to the point, I think they're just trying to try out as many people, mainly from the batting perspective. You also have Mukesh Kumar, whom I didn't think would be picked, let alone play all three formats. Right, I thought he's still maybe potentially a few months away from selection, but you see, they are trying to find out a new Bhuvi, if possible. Bhuvi is potentially very close to the exit rather than, right? And he's still injury prone highly. Umran Malik definitely needs more game time. He's not a definite starter in spite of his pace. Give him more game time. Kuldeep Chahal, you see, both might not make the squad of the World Cup. Right now, Kuldeep is far ahead of Chahal. Right, but you would be tempted to retain both because Jadeja is always a starter for you, right? And you would want to pick another guy who can bowl some decent off spin. The problem with the Indian top order is that Gill, Kishan, Kohli, Rohit, none of these guys bowl, right? These are all starters, more or less. Therein lies the problem, right? In a subcontinent condition, you want off spinning all rounders, so there comes your chances for Deepak Hooda, people like that. So I think they are trying to sort of finalize their 11, finalize their squad, not the 11. And therein comes all of these experimentations, promotion of batsmen suddenly up the order where you don't see them. I think for the Indian management, they're almost playing at home, given the conditions. And they can actually play the condition they have in mind, or the people they have in mind.
With all that in mind, I mean, I can't help but look at these ODIs with the World Cup in mind, because that's the point of these matches,
right,
isn't it?
It's right.
to work out who plays where. So when the World Cup does come round, are we saying that it will be Rohit Sharma and Shubman Gill opening with Kohli at three, and then who?
Surya at four.
Surya at four. I mean, they've been trying him at six, haven't they? So you think he will go back up to four?
Yeah.
And then what? Ishan Kishan with the gloves at five? And
if Rahul is fit, I think I still see him come back, but Sanju Samson's done enough to be given a slightly longer run right now. I think he's one of those people who's been unlucky. He's played a bunch of ODIs, only teen number of ODIs in like 7-8 years, right? So, and not all of it is down to his performances. Some of it is. So, I think they want to try and see if he can still be given a reasonable run. Kishan has made sure you can't drop him now, right? This is the nice thing. I mean, there is the shadow of a certain Pant lurking. He's far away. As far as the World Cup is concerned, he won't be there.
So then
Kishan has made himself undroppable. That's fantastic to see. And Rahul himself is, as far as this management is concerned, a very much tried and tested player, and they won't do without him if they have the option. If he's continuing to be injured, they don't have a choice. Well, that brings me to the quick point. There's also Shreyas Iyer to consider, remember?
Well, I mean, Shreyas Iyer, he's out injured at the moment, isn't he? So it's obviously not available for this. But then I start wondering, because in this series, that again with the World Cup in mind, I think India have tried to play, let's broadly call it an English style of ODI cricket. I know that's a simplification, and England didn't invent getting 350, but they did for 4 years leading up to the last World Cup,
right,
play a brand that other people were not doing. And then since the 2019 World Cup, we've seen more teams move to a more active, more progressive batting lineup. But I think India have definitely decided in this series that's what they're going to try and do. Is that something that Rohit and KL and Kohli to some extent, and Shreyas Iyer maybe, if they decide to go with him, is that something that they can do as well as the guys that have been picked for this West Indies series? I think it's a really, I think that's what I think I was getting at when I asked, do you not want to play the top six or top seven, as close to that as the World Cup, to see how roles work? Do we not want to see Kohli go out and bat first and regularly be the guy that takes India to 350. And I think he's certainly got that in his locker, particularly in this format.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of, if I was an India fan, I would want to see proof that Rohit and Kohli in a team are going to regularly produce 350. And I'm not sure we got that. That's the one criticism. I think India played well and destroyed the West Indies in two of those matches, to be brutally honest.
Mm-hmm.
And the pitch was the pitch in the one in between. But
I'll
say that. I think there's a few teams in India's boat, maybe not knowing the top six for their World Cup campaign and the exact tactics they'll use. But I was interested from that angle for this series, if not necessarily the actual matches that took place, right, which weren't always thrilling.
No, it was one-sided weirdly, all three, one way or the other. Look, for me, you have a good point, but I think they feel they know what Rohit and Kohli bring, and it might also be an attempt to get these two to get a little bit of thoughts going. I mean, look at how well these youngsters are playing. I have to now make, you know, my spot count. And between that, I think Australia tour India for an ODI series, if I'm not wrong, and then there's the Asia Cup.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
They have some ODIs against Ireland. So
yeah, they're coming up, aren't they? Because Bumrah is going to be the captain. Yeah,
precisely. So between these three, I have a feeling they are comfortable knowing the number of ODIs they have left, and probably half of those will be given, even more, probably more than half will be given the top seven and the bowling attack first choice, more or less. Right?
Okay.
So for them, this is still outside their playground. This is well outside, knowing that they're going into that phase. There's still injuries to consider, and maybe Rohit and Kohli might be given more breaks than normal from before, considering where they are from their career perspective. And well, Rohit, I mean, between the two of us, I even expect he might stop playing one or two formats at the end of this ODI World Cup. I don't know if you think the same, but yeah.
Look, I wouldn't be stunned. He's not a young man, and
not a swelled man.
He's got, like, is it a recurring hamstring problem that he has as well? And
back issues, knee.
Yeah, like he's all the batter's injuries, basically.
And
he'll always have a busy schedule. And I mean, he's such a good player, particularly now in Test cricket and so on, that you'd imagine there's years left in the tank for him. But he will always have a busy schedule because he's going to be playing in the IPL.
Mm.
And if he just played the IPL and Tests, that would still be a lot of cricket for somebody of his age.
I would say that's the way I see him going. I would say he'll give up ODI cricket first at the end of this World Cup.
Yeah.
And then I see him sort of deciding whether he'll play T20s, but also continue to play IPL quietly, and then sort of preserve his... I think you see, like, this guy wants to make a legacy for himself as a test captain of India. You really saw the anguish when they missed the World Test Championship final and so on. So he actually thinks that this is the real deal and he wants to get there. So let's see. Let's see if that's something he can do. And with, for Kohli, look, this is a true modern great for me. And he doesn't have much left to prove, except I think he'll want to at least win one trophy as a player.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it as a skipper. But of course, he's won the 2011 World Cup. He's won also a T20 World Cup. But then not later in his career, not for the last 10 years, right? He'll want to change that. So that's all he has to look forward to. And I'm not really surprised if Kohli completely takes himself out of the picture after the World Cup from all of limited overs cricket. Maybe he'll play test match cricket for one more year. But your thoughts?
I think he'll carry on. I think there's an element of the James Anderson there.
Yeah.
In a way.
Oh, the fitness, the drive. Yes.
Yeah, when you've got a player that is that good and is proven to be that good, sometimes when they play badly, we shouldn't be the ones saying they're bad now. It should be them that decides that they're the one. They know so much about their game,
right,
that they get to be the ones that say, yeah, I can't do this anymore. and make that call themselves. I don't know. I mean, I think it's more likely with Rohit that we'll see a scaling back than with Kohli.
Interesting. Let's see if that comes to pass. But why I'm asking you all of this is, we read a report that both Rahul and Iyer are not yet ready for the Asia Cup. That for me is a blow for both of them, I would think.
Oh, I think definitely. And I think definitely with the backdrop of other players in the team putting in performances. I would say maybe less of a blow for KL Rahul, who I think is probably established in that ODI team for the World Cup.
Right.
Shreyas Iyer was probably battling with some of the guys that have played well in this series and you know, hopefully from an India point of view, will play well in the Asia Cup.
Right.
And I expect that this will probably mean, if any of them play well, that he will slip back to being a reserve batter or maybe not even being in the squad for the World Cup. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's my take on that from afar.
No, I think you may have gotten it right. Look, the way Ishan Kishan has played, you won't want to drop him, right? The way Sanju Samson is putting his foot forward, there's more or less guaranteed he'll get a few more games between the Asia Cup, Ireland series and so on. He might still make that case. Against his wishes, between him and Iyer, I don't see too much of a difference when playing in subcontinent conditions. So he might just pip Iyer to the post there because Iyer is missing out on chances to play and he might be worried there. You're right. He might be rightly worried. Let's see how that goes. So, but let's wrap it up by quickly chatting about the first T20A. Surprised West Indies beat India or par for course?
A little bit. I mean, there's T20 cricket is a funny one in general, isn't it? Because it's so random in a way that you can have. I mean, very regularly, very good teams get beaten by teams that I think we would say are not good. So it happens. I think, you know, with respect to the West Indies winning, I think if there is a format that they're still a force in, it basically is T20 cricket, especially when they get their frontline 11 out. And you actually see that in terms of who gets picked up for tournaments like the IPL. Like there's still a currency in West Indies players in that tournament, and I think there's still recognition that a lot of them are very, very good cricketers, and some of them, you know, there's a few of the older guard have sort of shuffled out the door now, haven't they?
Right.
And made room in a way for some of the newer players to come through. And if you've been following T20 cricket broadly over the last year, you'll know how good a player like Nicholas Pooran is, for example. Yeah. And if you play a T20 cricket match against the team with Nicholas Pooran in, things can go wrong. And I know in this particular game, he gets, is it 40 off 30 balls? It's not a scintillating innings, but in the context of the match, it's quite important. And Rothman Powell, another guy who he has a partnership with and gets 48 himself, someone we've seen cause carnage in T20 cricket. Maybe not so much recently, but certainly in the past. And so I think it is always a possibility that the West Indies can beat a very good team in T20 cricket. And I think you'd probably say as well, if you look at the India team, that it's not their frontline 11. There's probably a handful of guys in there that in a World Cup situation wouldn't be in the team. So there's that to factor in as well. So I'm not massively surprised that this happened. I think the West Indies can still play that format, and I think they've still got some really, really, really good players.
I think given that pitch, how it behaved, 150 was not a bad score. And I think the real difference was the skipper, Rohman Powell, who played at a strike rate of 150. And then Brandon King gave them a bit of a start. Nicky Pooran sort of held it together. And then 150 is a pretty decent score. I think they were about 10-15 runs above par, and that's exactly how it went down. Because for India, look, Tilak Verma played out of his skin. He had a point to prove. He was on debut. He hit first ball for six. And wonderful, wonderful innings. So, but the game was sort of set up for Hardik Pandya and Samson to go at 8.2, 8.3 an over and wrap the game up. They couldn't get that done. Because you see, both of these players, Pandya, Samson, and also Yadav, Suryakumar Yadav, they couldn't go better than run a ball. Right? And then it took some plucky hitting from Akshar Patel, Arshdeep Singh. You know, they just kept coming. They just kept trying. But then it was not like you go in and start hitting. It was not that sort of a pitch at all. So that way also, I think Akhil Hussain started the game wonderfully for West Indies with the ball. And of course, Jason Holder showed his nous and experience there. And he held the middle overs quiet. He dismissed Hardik Pandya as well. So for me, I think West Indies came out deserved winners. India in this tour don't have much more firepower. What they'll count on is a much more friendly pitch. And what you said absolutely right, at the end of the day, look at what Nicky Puran did when he played for Mumbai Indians, New York, MINY. How do you call that team again? Mini?
I think people call them My New York, don't they? I'm not sure. I mean, I think they were calling them My Cape Town. So I think
that was
the
just
same
a joke.
Branding.
That was just a joke. Oh, it fell flat on its face. It's okay.
I mean, I think my take on the whole naming thing is that Mumbai Indians should come up with better branding for their overseas franchises than MI New York or MI Cape Town or MI whatever. But he was good for them. Is the cricketing factor the matter, particularly in that final where he was a cut above the rest of the players, I think.
Right. If you see in that finals, not many teams get away with chasing more than 180 in the final of a tournament. I mean, I know it happened. It was in IPL, but it was a shortened game, right? So in this case, probably Seattle Orcas thought they had done enough to set up 183. Yep. But then also the way they started with Stephen Taylor and Shayan Jahangir, you weren't sure if... Yeah, I mean, by the time Jahangir was out, already the score had run away to 15 runs an over or 12 runs an over and so on, because Puran had only one gear, sixth gear, 13 sixes. Strike rate of 250 over 55 balls in a T20 innings. Potentially, this might be the greatest ever batting innings in T20. We'll never know.
I mean, it is pretty good, isn't it?
In a final, chasing. That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. He got what is that? More than two thirds of the runs? Nearly 70% of the runs?
Yeah. That's, I mean, this is Bannerman territory. Yeah. This is Bannerman territory, right? Okay. All right.
Yeah, it was impressive.
No, I didn't see this. I didn't see any of this tournament, frankly. Were you able to catch any of the MLC at all?
I caught a little bit after I got back from a couple of cricket matches that I played in and watched it late at night. It's an interesting one, I think, the Major League Cricket. It's obviously the quality of the overseas players is preposterous. Some of the guys playing in this match and in the tournament as a whole walk into any franchise tournament first 11 that you can think of, and then at the same time you have, I mean, let's not beat around the bush, a developing nation in the USA. Their domestic scene is not really anywhere close to producing players that can match players like Puran. So you had these weird mismatches within the contest. It wasn't dissimilar to the IL20 that we saw earlier in the year, except that it was in America and it had a little bit of glitz and glam like that. From what I understand, it went over quite well. I think it's basically a startup, isn't it? The idea behind it is that there is some dormant television watching cricket fan base in the US, and that they think, the people who run this tournament, that they can activate that and that they can make some money from it. I mean, it is a money making endeavor.
Yeah, of course.
After all.
For sure.
And I think that actually this season, I doubt it made much money. I expect it lost quite a lot of money, but I think it provided a decent proof of concept that you can attract players to the USA, that you can have, you can produce decent cricket pitches, that you can broadcast it properly, that the players will care, and that you can produce great matches and great moments. And I think beyond that, I believe domestically it got picked up by one of the cable channels and was shown on on one of the sports networks. It wasn't just on Willow, which is the internet streaming service there.
Yeah.
So maybe, fingers crossed, from a global cricket point of view, maybe it did cut through a little bit. And I imagine we'll see some future iterations of it. I don't think it'll be a one and done bust type situation. It seems to go quite well.
Fair enough. So yeah, what we really saw is, one, it outdid itself when it came to expectations of, first of all, players that played in it, the results that it produced, the attraction of the audiences, and more importantly, just from purely from a cricketing perspective, I think they put out a good product, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you would think they give themselves definitely one or two more seasons. And I don't know if it's here to stay for a longer term like the BBL or IPL. We don't know that. But it's definitely started in the right way. So that's good news overall. And look, I'm happy to see everybody play cricket. And it's pretty much understood some countries are never going to target the longer format. One is in America, you're talking of audiences, the setup and so on. But even countries like Netherlands, I really don't ever see them playing the longest format, right? So from that perspective, I don't know if you agree with me, but those are my thoughts about Netherlands. We'll get to that shortly. But yeah, I think it's good that more countries play cricket and cricket becomes more of a global game.
I think you're about right, yeah. I can see countries like the Netherlands and even the USA, to be honest, playing some token long-form cricket at some point in the future, maybe not dissimilar to Ireland now, where they play two or three matches a year, almost to prove that they can, rather than with any sort of big vision realistically in mind. But yeah, I think certainly the shorter format lends itself to development and lends itself to the participation of a much wider group of cricketing countries than the longer matches.
Fair enough. Now, well, the dates for two of the World Cup games of Pakistan have been changed in consultation, we are told, with the PCB. Does it surprise you that there are still some tweaks going on to the schedule? I mean, literally 3 months out from the tournament.
Not really, to be honest. It's a very cricket move, isn't it? to be in a situation where months from the showpiece event, nobody knows where and when the teams will be playing each other, and it. It's something that cricket really should look at more broadly. It happens a lot, even for landmark test match series. So to take England v India coming up in January and February, I think it's January and February, later this year, in the UK, nobody knows which cut channel that's going to be broadcast on. so nobody can market it. The Ashes finished. Nobody could say on Sky Sports at the end of the Ashes, make sure you tune in to watch Bazball v India. Because if it's anything like the Ashes, that'll be a great watch, because nobody knows which channel it'll be on. I mean, the Sky don't know whether they'll have it. It could be on BT Sport. BT Sport, obviously, they can't market it at the moment, or TNT or whatever they're called, which is bizarre. And I think this is sort of just another example of cricket's general disorganisation in this area. I can see why it's happened. And I think, as my understanding is, that some of the boards weren't happy with the schedule because they felt that they had some very, very quick turnarounds where they had to travel a very long way between matches, and then sort of fallow periods where they didn't play for six days, which is a reasonably long time in the context of a World Cup. There's a lot of downtime.
Absolutely.
And so I think some of the teams were a little bit miffed that the schedule they had been given was the schedule that they got. What I don't really understand is why that discussion didn't happen in private 6 months ago, and then I don't know, at the beginning of the year or the end of the IPL or whenever it is, 6 months of the tournament, the schedule's released and we can all put the things in our calendar. And if you want to go to one of the matches, you can book it in. I mean, like, let's not even talk about the ticketing fiasco and how they're forcing people to have paper tickets. There's no digital ticket offering.
Yeah,
you literally have to go and pick up your physical tickets, which is baffling in 2023. There's no other sport in the world that I think would run a World Cup in that way.
That surprises me for a country that is actually sort of gaga over digital things, including payment, digital, and so on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a bit surprising.
I mean, the official reasoning is that it makes forgery more likely. But I mean, anyone who's ever been to a sporting event in Europe or the US knows that the de facto way to pick up your ticket now is through a phone app, which is very unforgeable, actually. It's quite difficult to generate a QR code on the gate and sneak your way in.
Right.
I would have thought it would be much, much easier to photocopy or scan a physical ticket and produce a decent replica. But I don't know.
I don't think they can understand even not even themselves with that reasoning. But well, I don't know if all the stadiums that are involved will have the technology already in place to scan at the entrances to grounds and so on.
My argument there, what an unbelievable opportunity to upgrade all your facilities. There's a World Cup. It's basically free money.
Exactly. No, I even thought all that delay was because they were doing all this behind the scenes. Normally, you would expect the itinerary to go out 6 months, a year ahead of time so that people who cover it, fan groups can travel together and so on. They can plan it. Right, none of this was done. So that's when I thought all of this is being held back because they're actually going up a couple of tiers with the stadiums, with the arrangements, with the seating and so on. So that's already one of the things, right, people are going to look forward to very, very carefully, because the Indian stadium experience is not the same as a European one or an Australian one or a South African one, even, we are told, right? So this is going to be interesting. All right. So let's see if they have any more topics to throw out. Go on.
One final point on that. There was a conspiracy theory that went around on the internet. I don't know if you saw this, about why they changed the date of the Pakistan v India match. It was from the 15th to the 14th.
I heard it was upon the. I'll tell you what I heard. Right, what I read.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It was by the recommendation of the police department or somebody, the security forces, because I think there was a festival on that day or on 15th or something. They wanted to do it one day before. Isn't that the original?
Now, I think that's the real reason, but the conspiracy theory was much more interesting. It's got something to do with Babar Azam's birthday, which is the 15th of October. Now, he's played a number of matches on the 15th of October for Pakistan, and Pakistan have never lost when Babar Azam has played on his birthday. And so the conspiracy theory was that India was scared that the luck was against them if they played a game on Babar Azam's birthday, so they wanted to change the date so that they didn't fall for that curse.
I sense I smell a neighborly plot in the story, but it's all right. It could be. Look, we people who come from Indian subcontinent are terribly, terribly, how shall I say, we believe in charts. We are very orthodox in certain ways, but also we are very, we believe in auspicious things. Flight of birds and all that. But yeah, it could be. I'm not surprised if that's the real reason. Not at all, believe you me. But I mean, what they put out is that there is some festivity around the corner and the police are not happy with how much support they can provide. That's at least the air quotes real reason for now. But fantastic. All I'm saying is I hope they don't throw up too many more such last minute surprises. Not everybody involved will be happy, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, I agree.
All right. India's Manoj Tiwari has retired from all forms of cricket. A champion batsman, I thought. I mean, he would have been a perfect fit in a one-day team. And I mean, I think his last one-day innings, his last international innings was 100.
That's not a bad way to go out. Yeah.
No, no. I mean, frankly, he set up an alternate career in politics where, I mean, he made some time out of that to play cricket this year at the first class level. So not a bad way to go, not a bad time of the, not a bad time of his life or, you know, of his career to say I've done. I mean, 19 years is a long time and he's done quite a lot of good for himself, for the teams he's played. So we wish him all the best going forward, Manoj Tiwari. And I suspect this might not be the last time we hear his name, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do get what you mean. It's not a nice life. It's not a bad life, to be honest, is it? If you can take time out of your main job to play a little bit of first-class cricket because it's your passion.
Precisely.
Most of us are lucky if we get a game in at the weekend.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fair enough. Now, some more news. Some more subcontinent news. Misbah, Hafiz and Inzamam are now a part of a cricket technical committee from Pakistan, which will, among other things, also review the coach appointments. We hear multiple things, sometimes contradictory, sometimes that go along together, much like most of the announcements that come out of certain part of the world. So in this case, at least we hear Misbah will head the committee, Hafiz and Inzamam will be a part of the committee. Then we hear they are all equally part of the committee. And some people said the coaching appointments are final. Some people said, no, nothing is final. Nobody said it's all final. So it's going to be very interesting. Your thoughts on this? Misbah was very vocal against appointment of somebody else from outside as the coach of Pakistan. Now, there's a director of cricket who's from outside. There's a coach who's from outside.
To be honest, I find Pakistani administration to be one of the most entertaining parts of the sport. Now, it's a real, I think you've got to be a real cricket purist to get into it and to know the ins and the outs. But I like this move. From the point of view of entertainment and what it might lead to, I like this move. I think in the long run, it will deliver a funny storyline. And I like that this is the setup to the punchline that will be coming around the corner. Misbah, after all, is the man who was actually himself responsible for appointing the Pakistan coach at one point.
And he appointed himself.
Yeah, but he had criteria, didn't he? Which was must have coaching experience for multiple years in charge of a major nation. I think that was his criteria, appointed himself a man with no coaching experience whatsoever, let alone of a major nation. So, I look forward to seeing what they come up with. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to have ex-leaders in advisory positions. It's worked well for England, I think, in the past with Andrew Strauss notably providing input, and they don't necessarily always follow it, England, or they didn't necessarily follow his most recent recommendations, but having somebody think about these issues and present ideas isn't a problem. I think where it might be a problem in this case is that they might suggest something that isn't too smart, and it might be followed through on.
Nah, that's the deal with at least how the think tanks work or the leadership, the management behind the scenes as far as Pakistan is concerned work. It's always a merry-go-round. You're off the carousel for a short while, then you're back on it. It's the same people in different roles. I've heard this before. I've seen this before, deja vu and all that. I sense a change around the corner. However, I think Mickey Arthur retains a bit of respect from Misbah. And he's the sort of cricket director, isn't he? So, and Grant Bradburn has just delivered a 2-0 result. That's quite tough to shake off, no matter who
you Pakistan,
are.
And Pakistan played really well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They played the way they should have been playing for the last 2 years.
No, 100%. So I thought they took a leaf straight out of baseball and they decided to play attacking cricket. And that's fantastic. And if it doesn't matter who's really at the helm, this thought process is what I really like. And to see people like Shaan Masood, see, you know, they're all capable of playing one-day cricket, even T20 cricket, most of these players in the 11. But the thought process to say, I'm going to own the game, I'm going to sort of put my foot forward, the way they batted on the very first test, the first innings, where they were actually under pressure. You know, if one more wicket there could have really determined the series almost. But there you go. So their belief worked out. In spite of not a lot of big runs from Babar, they got significant victories in both the tests. So I'm just thinking, right, if you go back, they have the right person at the job right now. And I don't know what the advisory committee has to say, the technical committee and so on. But let's see. I'm very curious on that. Now, last couple of stories, frankly. One has just broken out. Even as we started broadcasting, this has come up. So a couple of episodes ago, we had speculated there have been no extensions to the coaching staff of RCB. And it has come through by the looks of it, because basically, Andy Flower might be the person who might de-seat Mike Hessen. Because August 31st was Hessen's last day as the coach of RCB. And we hear his contract was not renewed. Neither was Sanjay Banger and all of those people, right? The entire coaching staff. So potentially it might be Andy Flower stepping into the role of director of operations. Thoughts?
I think it's a sort of an interesting one. I mean, like, I know Andy Flower's got a lot of respect in the game. And I don't mean that in terms of, you know, he's a name that people recognize. I mean that people within the game, when you talk to them, really rate Andy Flower and what he has to say and how he organizes teams. I do wonder with him whether some of that respect is earned from a more traditional perspective, and whether he is one of those coaches that maybe isn't the most progressive, if that makes sense. I think if I were running an IPL franchise right now, I would be looking for somebody. I mean, I don't want to say younger because that makes it sound a bit ageist, but somebody from the generation of coaches that thinks a little bit more about strike rate and analytics in a way that I don't know for sure that Andy Flower does, as strong a leader as he may be and as well respected as he may be within the game. On the other hand, you know, and there are always two sides to this, aren't there?
Yeah.
There are a few quite big egos in that RCB dressing room, and maybe bringing in somebody with the gravitas of Andy Flower to call the shots is what they need. I don't think RCB are far away from being a really good team.
They just don't get any lizards.
Yeah, maybe somebody who can galvanize them and be more of a motivator is what they need rather than an analytical coach, although I would tend towards having somebody who is of that nature.
I get the feeling they might actually hire an assistant coach or a batting coach who's more, air quotes, younger, more, or whatever you said, right? Somebody who's more into analytics, more into...
It's interesting. I mean, if you wanted to have a look through their coaching staff at the moment, I think Trent Woodhill's attached, isn't he? And I wonder...
I don't know if he's somebody...
Well, if he isn't retained, he's the sort of player who, who is regarded as a little bit more modern. So, you know, maybe who knows whether they will stick around. Like, this could be a complete clear out. But if he does, maybe he, someone like him could be the sidekick, if you like.
I mean, frankly, I thought they've been having a clear out once a year, more or less, and got nowhere. I was hoping Hessen might be the guy, and Banger, who's the assistant coach and has a lot of experience, might be the right sort of people to take them to the next step. But okay, I mean, another merry-go-round. By the way, nothing is confirmed. It's all sort of in the air while we wait. So the last news is Tamim Iqbal. Well, he's stepped down as the Bangladesh ODI captain, we hear. Again, news breaking only a couple of hours ago, and he's out of the Asia Cup with a back injury.
This was inevitable, right? I mean, I think the guy tried to retire, and then the Prime Minister of Bangladesh rang him up and convinced him not to.
Or as one of our guests so fine, maybe threatened to throw him off a helicopter if he did it. I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, well, that's your guesswork, not mine.
Fair enough.
But certainly said something convincing to Tamim. I think it's fair enough from his perspective. He said he'll hang around and he'll commit to the team. Being captain, and I think there's another element to this. If you're the captain of a smaller nation, you're more than the captain. You end up being the coach and organizing things, and you've got to invest in the players to get them to want to play for you and to actually turn up themselves. It's not, Bangladesh aren't a team where it's a given that somebody like Shakib Al-Hassan will definitely play. Part of your job as captain is to nudge players like that into the definitely play camp and to get them to play all the time. That's hard work. That's really hard work. That's not just deciding who bolts when on the field, or you know, working with the analysts to remember who does what, or even doing the press conferences after the game. It's a full-time ambassadorial role. And I think if you're someone like Tamim, who's maybe thinking that then not in it for the long haul and that they want to scale back themselves, captaincy isn't the job for you. So I think it's a good decision from him.
Yeah, makes sense. I also think, you know, I mean, he should have been sacked as the captain the moment he returned as a player. But those are my thoughts, right? I mean, you don't pull a stunt like, I want to retire, I don't want to retire. I mean, I don't know. I'm a bit more old school potentially. Some things you do once and you do it correctly and then you walk away. You don't revisit it again and again. But I mean, we know in Asia and South Asia specifically, players tend to come and go. People like Afridi may have retired, unretired quite a few times and so on. But all right, that's okay. Now, those are all the news topics we wanted to discuss. But, you know, now that I have you here, I would like to know more about Jack the Lad. What makes Jack tick? What brought you to cricket? What's keeping you here?
So I think probably familial connections is what brought me to cricket. So my granddad was a good player back in the day. And we're talking back in the day. Obviously, I'm 31, so
all right.
My granddad isn't alive anymore, but he'd be well into his 90s now. He played cricket with Dennis Compton.
Wow,
way back. Yeah. In London, in a London representative side. So he had the bug and played and introduced my dad and my dad's brothers, and so it came from there. Basically, it was family that brought me to the game. I can't give you a memory that made me think, yep, that cricket's for me. I think I was probably playing before I ever watched any cricket. I think it was one of those things, playing in the back garden with granddad when I was a boy. So that's what brought me to the game. And then what's kept me around? I think the stories and the way the game develops and changes and is a constant contradiction between innovation and conservatism, and how it provides an interesting window into sort of humanity in general, but also, don't get me wrong here, like I'm not equating sport to anything more than it should be. Well, no, that's what I mean. I mean, like, it provides an interesting window into humanity and those contradictions, whilst at the same time being something fun and enjoyable that those things can be expressed through. You can have an argument about whether pressure is a real thing through the context of the medium of cricket, or whether you should be conservative or whether you should be progressive through the medium of cricket, and nobody's going to get hurt because ultimately it is just a game. I suppose on top of that, the actual playing of the game throws up these amazing battles, doesn't it, in a way that other sports don't. The battle between bowler and batter is a brilliant and maybe not completely unique, but almost unique aspect to the sport, that two players can go at each other for, you know, a period of 6 balls or 12 balls or, you know, however long it is in a test match. And we can get a measure of who can stand up to that and who can be the best. And I think it throws up these fascinating stories all the time. And I think there's another element to it as well in terms of global sport, in that cricket feels still slightly undeveloped in a way. Particularly, I mean, speaking from an English point of view here, if you compare it to football, the way the media cycle works with that and the hype around it and the money and the investment and so on, sometimes that can be quite alienating for myself. Whereas with cricket, I think the stories are slightly more human, and I maybe identify with them a little bit better. So that's what keeps me around. And I've also averaged 40 with the bat for the last three seasons.
Perfect.
So that's not too bad too.
Not at all. I mean, no matter where you play, that's fantastic. And what keeps you talking about it? All of these things, but also to put your thoughts out there.
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting one. So the cricket podcast, we started that in 2019 as a pure hobby, to be honest. It was myself, Max and Ross, pretty much wanting to get together and have a couple of beers once a week and talk cricket. And we thought, slightly arrogantly, that the world would want to hear that, I think. And so we recorded it and we put it out there. And now 428 episodes later, we're still going.
Wow.
I think what keeps us interested, what one is for all the reasons I just talked about. Like, I think it's a brilliant game, and it's fascinating to involve yourself in it and to get invested and to follow these plots as they unfold. It's extremely rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think the interaction with the audience, the people we've met along the way, has been enriching as well. I mean, like, I wouldn't be here talking to you now without the podcast, for example. And I think
absolutely,
I think that's a big part of it. And I think that's why it basically still is a hobby. I think that's why most people still doing this sort of thing,
mm-hmm,
are invested, is because they enjoy it and they like the things it throws up, and they like creating content for if you were a marketing analyst, I think that's probably what you'd say it was. And that's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, I enjoy listening to your podcast, and I did not know you had so many episodes out there. That's quite something. So well done, and a lot more power to you and the rest of you who do it, and long may it continue.
Thanks. Yeah. Been an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. Same here. Love talking to you. I hadn't seen how much time we had spent, and now I'm a bit worried if I kept you for too long, but all right. Thank you very much for your time, and would love to have you sometime again, time and other things permitting. We also wish all our listeners a good day, wherever they may be listening from. Have a nice rest of the evening, Jack. I'll catch up with you shortly. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.